although he did manage to suppress reports of the Armenian victory. He had no intention of allowing Antony a Roman triumph, which would have counted for a very great deal. The donations may have been at the time little more than an exercise in Alexandrian grandiosity, in Ptolemaic boasting, a provocative display of symbols, Antony's version of erecting a golden statue of Cleopatra in the Forum. At best, the celebrations were simply tone-deaf. At worst, they were an insult to Octavian, a brazen power play. The intention hardly mattered, given how the exercise looked in Rome, which was how Octavian wanted it to, as an empty gesture, a farcical overreaching by two slightly demented, power-drunk dissolutes, a Dionysiac revel led by an Eastern harlot. With the donations, a munificent Antony handed out plenty of gifts, none more generous than he settled on Octavian. Chapter 8. Illicit Affairs and Bastard Children. For talk is evil. It is light to raise up quite easily, but it is difficult to bear and hard to put down. No talk is ever entirely gotten rid of, once many people talk it up. It too is some god. Hesiod. Cleopatra turned 35 without a change in her considerable and accumulating good fortune. The year ahead promised to be among the happiest and most auspicious of her reign. With her hybrid family, she had ingeniously solved the Roman problem, the consort problem, the shrinking empire problem. She no longer needed to be propped up by foreign troops, nor could any Alexandrian critic conceivably object to her friendship with a Roman. She had tamed that power and augmented Egypt through its largesse. With the donations, she experienced a surge of popularity. Her shipyards were busy as she doubled the size of Antony's navy. The revenues flowed in, from Damascus and Beirut in the east to Tripoli in the west. Cities minted coins in her honor. She had made good on a third-century poet's promise by which a Ptolemy, simultaneously safeguarding and supplementing his inheritance, outweighs all other monarchs in wealth, given the abundance that flowed hourly to his sumptuous palace from every quarter. Antony obliged her in her greatest desire. After the celebrations, he did not return to Rome, where he might have fleshed out his army with new recruits and neutralized Octavian's influence. Nor did he even journey to Antioch, a logical base for an Eastern operation. Instead, he settled down for a third festive winter in Alexandria, an imperial city that felt increasingly like the home of a new empire. In vivid illustration of the point, Cleopatra either put the finishing touches on or began to enjoy the newly constructed Caesareum, her vast harborside complex, which she may have modeled on the Forum of Rome. Fusing Egyptian and Greek styles, the Alexandrian version was slathered with gold and silver, stuffed with paintings and statuary, embellished with galleries, libraries, porches, courts, halls, walks, and consecrated groves, as glorious as expense and art could make them. Cleopatra stood at the helm of the mighty power that a nervous Roman had, a century earlier, predicted Egypt might one day be, if ever that kingdom found capable leaders. Around her assembled loyal, long-serving advisors, dedicated Romans, and an extended family, which by year's end included the teenaged Marcus Antonius Antyllus, the elder of Antony's two sons by Fulvia. Cleopatra took the children's schooling seriously. In the wake of the donations, she entrusted their education in part to Nicolaus of Damascus, a lanky diplomat's son, several years her junior, with a ruddy face, an affable temperament, and a taste for Aristotle. Handy with an anecdote, Nicolaus was a gifted logician, the kind of man you could rely on to finish your speech persuasively and eloquently, if you happened to dissolve into tears before you reached its end. He moved into the palace. Under his guidance, Cleopatra's children read philosophy and rhetoric, but especially history, which their new tutor deemed the proper study of kings. Genial though Nicolaus may have been, he was sharp-tongued when necessary and a relentless taskmaster. His idea of leisure would be to add 25 volumes to his comprehensive history of the ancient world, already 140 volumes long, and a project its author compared to the labors of Hercules. Around the children, the festivities and frivolities continued. Many threw themselves into court life with enthusiasm. Lucius Munatius Plancus, one of Antony's closest advisors and a former provincial governor, appeared at a dinner naked and painted blue. He entertained Cleopatra's banqueters with his best sea nymph imitation, wriggling across the floor on his knees, attired only in a fishtail and a crown of reeds. The taste for indulgence was contagious, or possibly inherited. At dinner one night, a physician from young Antyllus's retinue began to pontificate, boorishly and interminably. When a second court physician stopped him in his windy tracks, it was the former medical student who had toured Cleopatra's kitchen. Antyllus whooped with delight. With a wave of his arm, he gestured to the sideboard. "All of this I bestow upon thee, Philotas," he exclaimed, forcing a collection of gold beakers on the quicker-witted of his guests. Philotas hardly took the teenager at his word, but nonetheless found himself presented with a bulging sack of elaborately worked antique vessels. He headed off with its cash equivalent instead. Throughout the city, the music, mimes, and stage productions continued. As one clever stonemason saw it, the merry pact that joined Antony and Cleopatra merited an alternate interpretation. From December 28, 34, survives a basalt inscription, presumably from a statue of Antony. Whatever Cleopatra made of his ardent affections, the Alexandrians wholly reciprocated. The sporting Antony is hailed in stone not as an inimitable liver, but, the pun requires more of a stretch in Greek than in English, the inimitable lover. Official business was by no means neglected among the revelries. Cleopatra continued to receive petitions and envoys, to participate in religious rites, to mete out justice. She supervised economic discussions, met with advisors, and presided over the innumerable Alexandrian festivals. Increasingly, state business included Egypto-Roman business. Legionnaires had been posted in Egypt for half of Cleopatra's lifetime. In one account, her Roman bodyguards now inscribed her name on their shields. And in a mutually beneficial arrangement, Roman futures were decided in Alexandria rather than the other way around. In 33, Cleopatra dictated an ordinance to a scribe in which she awarded a substantial tax exemption to one of Antony's top generals. Publius Canidius had served in Parthia and distinguished himself in Armenia. For his services, Cleopatra accorded him a waiver of export duties on 10,000 sacks of wheat and import duties on 5,000 amphorae of wine. He was exempted from land taxes in perpetuity, a privilege Cleopatra extended equally to his tenants. Even Canidius's farm animals were to be above taxes, requisition, seizure. Footnote. There was some irony in Canidius's good fortune. As a young man, he had been charged with transporting to Rome the treasure of Cleopatra's deposed uncle, the king of Cyprus. There had been some concern over whether Canidius could be trusted to acquit himself honestly of that lucrative task. End of footnote. It was an agile way to keep Antony's men both loyal and local, in the unlikely event that the enchantments of Alexandria proved insufficient. It was also a more effective way of courting an ambitious Roman than paying bribes, which, it has been noted, only make them come back for more. Much of their business, the Roman triumvir and the Egyptian queen, transacted together. Cleopatra frequented the marketplace with Antony, joined him in the management of festivals and in the hearing of lawsuits. At her urging, Antony took charge of the city's gymnasium, as he had done in Athens. As de facto leader of the Greek community, he directed its finances, teachers, lectures, athletic contests. With Cleopatra, he posed for painters and sculptors. He was Osiris or Dionysus, to her Isis or Aphrodite. In mid-33, Antony marched again to Armenia, where he arranged a peace with the Median king. They would henceforth serve each other as allies against the Parthians and, if need be, against Octavian. Asia was now quiet. Antony returned to Alexandria with the Median princess Iotope, Alexander Helios's intended. With the donations, Antony and Cleopatra had sent Octavian one unmistakable message. Whatever they intended for the East, their plans did not include him. The two men were still in touch, closely and more or less cordially. Envoys and informers frequently sailed between them. They continued to correspond with mutual friends. They were joined in the triumvirate through the end of 33. They were free now of both Lepidus and the intractable Sextus Pompey, with whom they had dispensed. Defeated by Octavian, Sextus was executed, most likely on Antony's orders. Antony had reason to feel invulnerable, and sent another message to Octavian at about this time. He would relinquish his powers and restore a republic in Rome if Octavian would agree to do the same. Antony may have been bluffing. He may have been expending cheap political capital. Roman titles and the composition of the Roman government were of little concern to him in the East, where he seemed inclined to remain. He got a straightforward reply, which may even have been the one he expected. For some time it had been clear where the long Alexandrian sojourn, the repudiation of Octavia, the recognition of Caesarion were leading. Friends had surely kept Antony and Cleopatra apprised of the mood in Rome. Early in the year, Octavian rose in the Senate to deliver a virulent, direct assault on his colleague. From that point on, it is impossible to say which was greater: Alexandria's royal extravagances, or Rome's version of them; Cleopatra's ambition, or Rome's version of it; Antony's affections for Cleopatra, or Rome's version of his affection. Cleopatra's palace was certainly the most luxurious building in the Mediterranean world in 33, but it never looked as magnificent as it did from Rome that winter. Antony and Octavian had years of bad blood on which to trade. When finally the floodgates opened, they unleashed a torrent. Each accused the other of misappropriating lands. Octavian demanded his share of the Armenian spoils. Antony sputtered that his men had received no part of Octavian's distributions in Italy. Octavian replied that if Antony wanted land, he was free to carve up Parthia, an accusation that must have stung. Octavian condemned Antony for the murder of Sextus Pompey, a murder that Octavian had himself celebrated in Rome, and that had followed Sextus's defeat at Octavian's hands. Footnote: Sextus Pompey complicated the picture from many angles. He enjoyed warm relations with several monarchs considered to be deadly enemies of Rome, and Cleopatra was well disposed toward him, given their father's relationship. He, in fact, made overtures to Cleopatra, which Antony discouraged. He was wise enough to see he should not be in league both with a foreign queen and a swaggering compatriot who, despite popular support at home, behaved like a pirate. Antony's instincts were correct. Ever the adventurer, Sextus had simultaneously offered up his services to the Parthians behind Antony's back. According to Appian, Antony refused to sign the order for Sextus's execution. He was ashamed to do so personally, as he knew the death would displease Cleopatra, and did not want her to hold him responsible. Appian likewise suggests that sentence was desirable. Better to eliminate Sextus, lest that talented naval commander and Cleopatra league together to disturb the auspicious respect which Antony and Octavian had for each other. End of footnote. Antony denounced Octavian for having unlawfully forced aside Lepidus, and what had happened to his right to raise troops in Italy. Octavian had long obstructed those efforts, to which he had agreed by treaty. He left Antony to assemble an army of Greeks and Asiatics. For that matter, where was the remainder of the fleet Antony had lent Octavian 4 years earlier? And the 18,000 men Octavian had promised in exchange. Antony had been scrupulously faithful to their agreements. Octavian had not, repeatedly summoning Antony to meetings at which Octavian failed to appear. As ever, nothing worked as effectively as personal invective. The more scurrilous, the better. Antony taunted Octavian with accounts of his humble origins. He was descended on his father's side from rope makers and money changers, on his mother's from bakers and keepers of perfume shops. For good measure, Antony threw in an African grandfather. Worse, Octavian the parvenu harbored divine pretensions. When the grain shortages plagued Rome, he and his wife Livia had thrown a lavish banquet. Their guests arrived in costume as gods and goddesses. They ate obscenely well, with Octavian presiding over the table in the guise of Apollo. Octavian was, moreover, a coward. He had disappeared for days on end at Philippi. His gifted lieutenant, Marcus Agrippa, fought his battles for him. Possibly to deflect attention from Cleopatra, and certainly overlooking his Median arrangements, Antony ridiculed Octavian for attempting to marry off his daughter to a barbarian for the sake of a political alliance. Not all of the accusations were false or even vaguely fresh. Some were neatly repackaged from 44, when Cicero's account of Antony's misdeeds had been so extensive that it was conceded no one man could ever suffer adequate punishment for them all. Where Antony alleged that Octavian was disabled by fear, Octavian asserted that Antony was undone by drink. On that front, Octavian had several advantages. He was a modest drinker, or at least advertised himself as one. Alexandria threw a better party than did Rome, and Octavian had history on his side. It was fairly easy to claim that Antony had disappeared into a bacchanal, the more so as Octavian was in Rome, while Antony was not. In his defense, Antony countered with a satiric pamphlet on his drunkenness. Generally, 33 was a heyday for poets, lampoonists, apologists, graffitiists, as for all lovers of idle talk and outlandish fictions. Intrigue came more naturally to Octavian than to Antony, but both men displayed a pitiless talent for defamation. Octavian resorted to indecent verse. Antony distributed slanderous handbills. Each man engaged propagandists. Many practices once acceptable were suddenly objectionable. Antony took charge of the gymnasium in Alexandria, which was unspeakable, whereas his having done so 5 years earlier with Octavia in Athens had elicited no comment. Similarly, Antony's affair with Cleopatra had once afforded an endless source of ribald dinner jokes. Such had been the case over the summer of 39 in a celebration near Naples. Cleopatra was where the conversation wound up as the evening reached full tilt, when the lusty good fellowship was at its height. She was a laughing matter, no longer. The pummeling continued both above and below the belt. Between them, Antony and Octavian covered the usual schoolyard litany. effeminacy, sodomy, cowardice, unrefined or overly refined practices of personal hygiene. Octavian was a veritable weakling. Antony had passed his prime. He could no longer win any contest save those in exotic dancing or the erotic arts. Antony sneered that Octavian had slept with his illustrious granduncle. How else to account for his unexpected adoption? Octavian countered with something sturdier and more pertinent, if equally untrue. Cleopatra had not slept with his granduncle. Caesarion was hardly the divine Caesar's son, news Octavian enlisted a pamphleteer to disseminate. Antony condemned Octavian's hasty marriage to Livia, hugely pregnant with another man's child on her wedding day. He decried Octavian's habit of making off with the wives of his banquet guests and returning them disheveled to the table. He advertised Octavian's well-known and in all probability invented habit of procuring and deflowering virgins. According to Suetonius, Octavian seduced scientifically. He targeted the wives of his enemies to learn what the husbands were saying and doing. In the depravity department, Octavian had no need to resort to fictions. He had his weapon close at hand. In defiance of Roman custom and his impeccable Roman wife, Octavian's fellow triumvir disported himself in a foreign capital with a rapacious queen, on whose account he had lost his head, forsaken his illustrious country, and shed all remnant of his manly Roman virtues. What self-respecting Roman would, as Cicero had put it, foolishly prefer invidious wealth, the lust for despotism, to stable and solid glory? In many ways, the contest boiled down to one of magnificence versus machismo. At some point in the year, Antony replied to Octavian privately with a letter of which one scrap survives. He does not sound like a man spoiling for a fight, nor does he sound out of his mind with love in the throes of a transporting passion. The 7 surviving lines dedicated to Cleopatra have been translated in countless ways, from the indecorous to the risque to the raunchy. The last is the most precise. Antony's tone was unsurprising for Rome, where political and financial considerations determined upper-class marriages. Sex could be had anywhere. What, demanded Antony in 33, had come over Octavian? Why the fuss, exactly? Could it really matter so much that he was screwing the queen? Octavian was no model husband himself, as they both knew. Footnote. Antony named names, 5 in all. Elsewhere he noted that Octavian had divorced his previous wife on the grounds of moral perversity. She had been a poor sport about his mistress. End of footnote. Nor was he an innocent. He had amply enjoyed what Antony termed their amorous adventures and youthful pranks. It was only sex, after all, and hardly qualified as news. As Octavian well knew, Antony's relationship with Cleopatra had been going on for 9 years. He dated it from Tarsus. It is not entirely clear whether he meant to legitimize the affair or to diminish it. The line that follows screwing the queen can be rendered as, she is my wife, or, is she my wife? Given the rapid-fire rhythm of his queries, Antony seems intent on downplaying the liaison. He was, after all, writing to his brother-in-law. His implication appears to be, she isn't my wife, is she? The answer was, in any event, immaterial. Does it really matter, Antony concluded, where and in whom you get it up? No matter how his final phrase is rendered, its verb belongs to the animal kingdom. It is unclear how closely those 7 vulgar lines hewed to reality. What has come down to us may well be a paraphrase, more salacious than the original. Octavia aside, Antony and Cleopatra were not married by Roman standards, as Cleopatra well knew. In any event, she here stepped into, or was fitted into, her greatest role. Octavian needed nothing further with which to bludgeon his rival. Judging from the fragments that remain, it was Octavian who turned the Alexandrian idyll into a sultry love affair. As the clock ticked toward the end of the triumvirate, unlikely to be renewed, Antony and Cleopatra decamped for Ephesus. Ephesus had been the first city to recognize Antony as Dionysus incarnate and to have welcomed him at the city gates with loud cheers and a musical medley. After Philippi, he had offered up splendid sacrifices and generous pardons there to a people brutalized by Caesar's assassins. The city of 250,000 remained kindly disposed toward him. He arranged now for the Ephesians to greet Cleopatra as his royal mistress, a rich banking center of narrow streets and shady marble colonnades. Ephesus enjoyed a magnificent location. Built in a steep-sided valley, it gave on to rugged mountains on one side, the sea on the other. Ephesus boasted several remarkable temples, of which the most celebrated was that of Artemis, where both Cleopatra's father and sister had sought asylum, and before the slender Ionic capitals of which her sister had met her end. Strategically located across the Aegean from Athens, at the edge of a fine harbor, Ephesus was also the ideal address at which to establish a military base. From the coast of Asia Minor, Antony set about assembling a navy, dispatching word to every client king in the region. They answered with fleets and submitted to oaths of loyalty. Cleopatra was the greatest single supplier of materiel, furnishing 200 of Antony's 500 warships, fully manned, along with 20,000 talents and all the supplies required to sustain a vast army. In this case, 75,000 legionnaires, 25,000 infantry, 12,000 cavalry, for the duration of a war. She was unlikely to have hesitated before doing so. Improbably, Octavian's star had ascended in Rome. He had piled up victories as Antony bogged down in the east. For the two triumvirs to coexist peacefully was difficult. For an implacable, ambitious Octavian and Caesarian to coexist was impossible. Unlike Parthia, this campaign was as vital to Cleopatra as to Antony. She had every reason to throw herself and Egypt into it. On the last day of 33, the triumvirate officially expired. Early in January 32, a new consul spoke out forcefully in the Roman Senate in praise of Antony. He went on to savage Octavian. On hearing of the denunciation, Octavian paid the Senate a visit with a bodyguard of soldiers and supporters. They made no effort to conceal the daggers beneath their togas. In 44, Cicero had wondered if Caesar's adopted son intended to stage a coup. He did so now. Offering his own scalding stream of accusations, he terrified the opposition into silence. By certain documents, Octavian promised to demonstrate that Antony constituted a threat to Rome. He fixed a date on which he would present his evidence. The opposing consuls had seen the daggers. They knew better than to await that session and secretly fled the city. Nearly 400 senators followed, sailing to Ephesus, where they reported on the political climate in Rome. Surely Antony underestimated Octavian's strength and position, and he allied himself with Cleopatra at great risk. She seriously compromised the cause. Many of Antony's colleagues, at least a third of the Senate was with him, argued for her removal. Yet again, Antony bowed to reason and agreed to dismiss Cleopatra. He ordered her to sail to Egypt and there await the result of the war. She refused, possibly, as Plutarch asserts, because she feared that Octavia would again intervene, to prevent a war that Cleopatra knew for her own sake to be essential. Possibly because she mistrusted Antony's judgment. Possibly because it would have been irresponsible to do otherwise. She was no warrior queen. Recent Ptolemies had not evidenced a great taste for warfare. They did not die on the battlefield, as did other Eastern monarchs. They subscribed to the belief that an empire could be acquired with money rather than money with an empire. She was, however, her men's commander-in-chief, responsible for their preparations and operations. She was as well Antony's paymaster. A sober struggle of wills ensued. This time, Cleopatra refrained from swooning hunger strikes. She took the opposite approach, assisted by Canidius, Antony's gifted general, whom she allegedly bribed to argue her case. He may just as easily have been impressed with her. Surely, Canidius protested, it was not fair to banish an ally so instrumental to their campaign. She fed the troops. She provided the fleet. She was as capable as any man. Did Antony not understand that the Egyptian crews would be demoralized by her departure? Those men formed the backbone of his navy. They would fight for their queen, not necessarily for a Roman general. Were Antony to refute his Egyptian affections, he would, moreover, offend his Eastern allies. Cleopatra challenged Antony to explain how she was inferior in intelligence to any one of the princes who took part in the expedition. She, who for a long time had governed so large a kingdom by herself, and she appended a compliment, by long association with Antony, had learned to manage large affairs. Either her arguments made sense, or her war chest did. She got her way. In April 32, Antony and Cleopatra sailed with Antony's staff to the island of Samos, off the coast of modern-day Turkey. Samos was a stepping stone to Greece, where the struggle for control of the Roman world would most likely take place. While the couple settled in on the mountainous island, their troops were ferried west across the Aegean, an operation that would have required a good month. Antony's veterans had returned from Armenia. Along with the Eastern recruits, he had assembled some 19 legions. Whatever the military or political preoccupations of the summer, they are lost to us, obliterated by Plutarch's descriptions of the merrymaking on Samos. The lush resort island was the ideal place to throw a party, and Antony was well positioned to do so. He had time on his hands. Octavian made much of the extravagance, which has come down to us as another Dionysian revel. Just as every king and prince east of Athens contributed forces, so every dramatic artist reported to Samos. They arrived in throngs. For days on end, the lute players and flutists, actors and dancers, acrobats and mimes, harpists and female impersonators, a rabble of Asiatic performers, delivered a resplendent multilingual festival of music and theater. And while almost all the world around was filled with groans and lamentations, Plutarch relates through pursed lips, a single island for many days resounded with flutes and stringed instruments. Theaters there were filled, and choral bands were competing with one another. Every city also sent animals for sacrifice. The client kings vied with one another in their mutual entertainments and gifts. The question on all minds was how Antony and Cleopatra would stage a triumph that could conceivably surpass the prodigal pre-war festivities. In May, Antony and Cleopatra made the short trip west to hilly Athens. The revels continued in the theaters and the vast marble-seated stadium of that city, which had welcomed Antony as Dionysus 9 years earlier, and where he may now have embraced the role most closely. It seemed that no one who could afford to had passed through Athens without contributing a sculpture, a theater, a gymnasium of creamy marble. When they did not, the Athenians erected the statue for them. Cleopatra's forebears had bestowed a gymnasium east of the marketplace. While sports and drama distracted Antony, two matters clarified themselves in quick succession. Cleopatra spent her summer in the storied city, where Antony had spent the bulk of his years with Octavia. Antony's wife had attended lectures in his company. They had conceived a second child there. She remained a vivid presence. Her statues adorned the venerable city, as did inscriptions in her honor. The Athenians embraced her as a goddess. The annual religious festival paid her tribute. This was unacceptable to Cleopatra, for whom much had changed in the 14 years since she had lived quietly across town from Caesar's wife. She had heard enough of what Lucan would term illicit affairs and bastard children. Cleopatra was, moreover, the first Ptolemaic queen to set foot in Athens, a city that had reason to warm to her. At various junctures, it had relied on her family for grain, for military assistance, for political refuge, since the beginning of the 3rd century. Athens had erected statues to earlier Ptolemies, including Cleopatra's great aunt. Cleopatra focused, however, on another woman. She had kept careful account of the tributes accorded Octavia. She was jealous. She went on the offensive, attempting, by many splendid gifts, to win the favor of the people. In other words, to blot out her predecessor's traces. Realistic and reasonable, the Athenians obliged, to Antony's delight. They voted his lover multiple honors. They planted statues of Cleopatra and Antony in the Acropolis at the center of the city. On one occasion, Antony appeared amid a delegation to pay Cleopatra tribute, delivering up a speech on the city's behalf. From the summer of 32 dates, too, a remarkable gift. Antony bestowed on Cleopatra the Library of Pergamum, the only collection that rivaled Alexandria's. The 4 rooms of that scenic hilltop library housed some 200,000 scrolls. For centuries, busts of Homer and Herodotus had kept them company. History has made of Antony's gift a wedding present, or recompense for the volumes Caesar inadvertently destroyed in the Alexandrian War. In context, the largesse required no explanation. Pergamum was not far from Ephesus. It is likely that Antony and Cleopatra paid a visit to that city a few days' ride away. For years, too, the way to assemble a collection had been to plunder someone else's. Already there was some tradition of this in Rome, where libraries were still in their infancy. For the most part, the reports of Antony's disorienting, degrading passion for Cleopatra date from the Athenian summer. If in Alexandria he had distracted her from state business, the tables now turned. He attended principally to her. Many times, while he was seated on his tribunal and dispensing justice to tetrarchs and kings, he would receive love billets from her in tablets of onyx or crystal and read them, Plutarch tells us. Antony was not the first to receive love letters on state occasions. Caesar, too, had received wanton bits during Senate sessions. That mistress did not write on onyx tablets, however. At one juncture, Cleopatra happened to ride conspicuously past the courts on the shoulders of her servants as Antony presided over a legal case. A distinguished Roman orator held the floor, or did until Antony caught sight of Cleopatra. He then sprang up from his tribunal and forsook the trial, and hanging on to Cleopatra's litter, escorted her on her way. It was ignoble behavior. A Roman could indulge in as diversified, as lurid a sex life as he pleased, but he was meant to be discreet and unsentimental in his affections. Pompey had made himself a laughing stock for his indecent habit of falling in love with his own wife. In the 2nd century, a senator was expelled from that assembly for kissing his wife in public, in full view of their daughter. Antony had been reprimanded years earlier for having openly nuzzled his wife. He was said these days to rise during banquets before his assembled guests to massage Cleopatra's feet, in compliance with some agreement and compact they had made. The relationship proceeded by pacts, wagers, and competitions, something Cleopatra evidently brought to the table. Antony was little inclined to formalities. The gesture was in itself offensive. One had servants for such indulgences, and the stories of what another age might term gallantry or devotion, of what the East deemed proper obeisance, of what were in Rome indecencies and indignities, piled up. Antony fawned over Cleopatra, which was what eunuchs did. He trailed her litter through the streets among her attendants, and this, sniffed the Romans, heaping upon the Egyptian queen the usual abuse of the other woman, when she was not even beautiful. From Octavian's point of view, the Athenian reports were too good to be true, as they may well have been. For all of the martial preparations, for all of the governmental irregularities in Rome, despite the gathering sense of inevitability, there was no real cause for a rupture. Antony and Octavian remained two men in search of a conflict. They found one in 32. Antony evidently felt some degree of attachment to Cleopatra, or felt with her invincible. In May, he divorced Octavia. From Athens, he instructed her to leave their comfortable home. We cannot know how much that gesture was directed at Octavia and how much at her brother, coming as it did after years of disingenuous reconciliations and flimsy agreements, after a season of slanders. It may only have preempted a salvo from the other direction. Octavia could have elected to end the marriage herself. The divorce itself was simple, an informal procedure for which there was no paperwork. Its ramifications were more complex. As Plutarch remarks on the death of Pompey's wife and Caesar's daughter, the family alliance, which had hitherto veiled rather than restrained the ambition of the two men, was now at an end. Cleopatra could only have been thrilled. Already she had enlisted a friend of Antony to distract him from all thoughts of his wife. Octavian was overjoyed. Octavia was bereft. Tearfully she packed her bags. With her she took her children by Antony, as well as his second son by Fulvia. There were no recriminations. Octavia worried only that she would be said to have precipitated a war. Insofar as a propaganda-free chronology can be established, relations were strained in Antony's camp well before the divorce. For all of the later assertions that high-born Romans lay powerless and enchanted at her feet, in 32 we hear no chime, no caress of Cleopatra's silvery voice. There were as many opinions on the looming conflict as there were advisers to Antony. For a variety of reasons, many of them legitimate, some continued to see Cleopatra as a liability. A military camp was no place for a woman. Cleopatra distracted Antony. She should not take part in a council of war. She was no general. Antony could not enter Italy in the presence of a foreigner, and was unwise to wait to do so. He frittered away his advantage on the Egyptian queen's account. The criticism did not bring out the best in her. At one point, Antony's associates in Rome dispatched his friend Geminius to Athens to plead their case. Antony must defend himself at home, where he was badly battered by Octavian. Why allow himself to be portrayed as a public enemy, in thrall to a foreigner? Geminius was an inspired choice for the delicate mission, having had some experience himself with what it was to fall unwisely and unreasonably in love. Cleopatra assumed that Octavia had dispatched him and treated Geminius accordingly. She kept him as far as possible from Antony. At dinner, she seated him among the least significant guests. She pelted him with sarcasm. Geminius endured the insults in silence, patiently holding out for an audience with Mark Antony. Before it was accorded, Cleopatra challenged Geminius, in the midst of a raucous dinner, to explain his errand. He replied that his details required a sober head, but one thing he knew, whether he was drunk or sober, and that was that all would be well if Cleopatra was sent off to Egypt. Antony erupted in fury. Cleopatra was more brutal. She commended Geminius for his honesty. He had spared her from having to torture him. Several days later, he fled to Rome to join Octavian. Cleopatra's courtiers failed equally to recommend themselves to the Romans, dismayed by the drunken tricks and scurrilities of the Egyptians. For reasons that are unclear, Plancus, the dancing fish of the Alexandrian revel, deserted as well to return to Rome. He was disgusted. The defection may have had nothing to do either with Cleopatra or her advisers. A born courtier, Plancus inclined to the path of least resistance. He betrayed every bit as well as he bowed and scraped. Treachery, it would be said, was a disease with him. He was, however, a man of impeccable political instincts. Something had clearly transpired to make him doubt that Antony, despite his outsized power and prestige, his years of experience, could prevail over Octavian. Plancus counted among Antony's closest advisers. For some time, he had been in charge of Antony's correspondence. He knew his secrets. He fled to Octavian with fulsome reports of foot massages, prodigal banquets, and high-handed queens, as well as with information concerning Antony's will, to which Plancus had been a witness. Octavian at once pried that document from the Vestal Virgins, with whom it should have been safe. In it, he found, or claimed to find, a number of scandalous passages. These he helpfully annotated so that he might read them aloud to the Senate. Most members of that body had no desire to participate in his transgression. A man's will was to be opened after his death, which was why it happened to be illegal to unseal such a document before the event. Those qualms vanished as Octavian neared the end of his presentation to reveal a heinous provision. Even if he should die in Rome, Antony had directed that his body should be borne in state through the Forum and then sent away to Cleopatra in Egypt. Footnote. No one saw the will other than Octavian, who may have fabricated it himself. Plancus may equally well have forged it. In urgent cases, he had authority to sign Antony's name and affix his seal. The document evidently included a confirmation of the gifts Antony had bestowed on Cleopatra's children, as well as of Caesarion's paternity. So far as we know, Antony never refuted the terms, nor, for that matter, did Octavian refute the claim regarding Caesarion, which at this point he was wiser to ignore. It is all the same difficult to imagine any circumstances under which Antony might actually have committed to paper the provisions Octavian read aloud. End of footnote. Genuine or not, the clause ignited a brilliant bonfire for which Octavian had relentlessly stockpiled kindling. In his January coup, he had promised the Senate documentary evidence against Antony. He now richly delivered. Suddenly, reports of Athenian excess, of Antony's subservience to Cleopatra, the sensational, salacious details of which had been widely understood to be falsehoods, appeared credible. In a world entranced by rhetoric, addicted to honey balls of phrases, every word and act besprinkled with poppy seed and sesame, the plausible reliably trumped the actual. Octavian had at his disposal plenty of generous veins to mine. The depredations of the East alone, that intoxicating, intemperate, irrational realm, supplied a motherlode of material. Like its queen, Egypt was beguiling and voluptuous, the modern association between the Orient and sex was hoary already in the first century. Already, Africa was the address of moral decay. From there, it was no great leap to transform the Antony of the Donations into a power-crazed, dissolute Eastern despot. In his hand was a golden scepter, at his side a scimitar. He wore a purple robe studded with huge gems. A crown only was lacking to make him a king dallying with a queen. It was the diadem and golden statues business all over again. The accessories of kingship unnerved Romans even more than did autocracy itself, which they had tolerated in a more subtle version for at least a decade. In Octavian's account, Antony was irredeemably contaminated by the Oriental languor and the un-Roman luxuries of the East, as, arguably, Caesar and Alexander the Great had been before him. In turn, Octavian would soon enough discover that Egypt conferred on its conqueror a mixed blessing, a literal embarrassment of riches. Like a prodigious trust fund, it convinced men they were gods. Octavian wrung the most mileage from Antony's affair with Cleopatra. She allowed him to recycle the oldest trope. The allergy to the powerful woman was sturdier than that to monarchy or to the depraved East. Whether or not Cleopatra controlled Antony, she unequivocally permitted Octavian to control the narrative. He had at his disposal a whole grab bag of Cicero's rantings against Fulvia, that avaricious, licentious virago. Diligent as ever, Octavian improved upon them. In his expert hands, the Egyptian affair blossomed into a tale of blind, irresponsible passion. Antony was under the influence of some powerful narcotic, bewitched by that accursed woman. Writing closest to events, Valius Paterculus provided the official version, distilled to pure cause and effect. Then, as his love for Cleopatra became more ardent, explains Valius, acknowledging Antony's embrace of Eastern vices, he resolved to make war upon his country. Cleopatra does not so much corrupt Antony as she melts and unmans him. In Octavian's version, she is masterful and Antony servile, a radically different account of the relationship than that which the sporting Mark Antony had supplied months earlier. Even while conceding that the charges were questionable, every chronicler subscribes to the party line. Antony became a slave to his love for Cleopatra. He gave not a thought to honor, but became the Egyptian woman's slave. He surrendered his authority to a woman to the extent that he was not even a master of himself. The construct was old enough to have a mythical equivalent, to which Octavian eagerly appealed. Antony claimed descent from Hercules. Octavian let no one forget that Hercules spent 3 years disarmed and humiliated as the slave of the rich Asian queen Omphale. She removes from him his lion skin and his club, and donning his lion skin herself, stands over him as he weaves. To the charges, Octavian fixed an imaginative twist. He needed, after all, to rally an exhausted, hungry country, depleted after nearly 2 decades of civil war. To the hot baths and the mosquito nets, the golden accessories and jeweled scimitars, the illicit affair and bastard children, he added a rousing fillip. The Egyptian woman demanded the Roman Empire from the drunken general as the price of her favors, and this Antony promised her as though the Romans were more easily conquered than the Parthians, relates Florus. Dio arrived at the same conclusion by way of more tenuous logic. For she so charmed and enthralled not only him, but all the rest who had any influence with him, that she conceived the hope of ruling even the Romans. Cleopatra already had the Pergamum Library. She had Herod's balsam gardens. Reports circulated that Antony pillaged the best art from the temples of Asia, including famed colossi of Heracles, Athena, and Zeus that had stood in Samos for centuries, to gratify the Egyptian queen. If Antony was to send his body to her, what would he conceivably deny her? And for what would she hesitate to ask? Octavian seems to have been the one who decided that Cleopatra plotted to make Rome a province of Egypt, an idea very unlikely to have crossed her quick mind. He had on his side the familiar type, the scheming spendthrift wife, for whom no diamond is large enough, no house spacious enough. As Eutropius put it centuries later, Antony began a war at the urging of the Queen of Egypt, who longed with womanly desire to reign in the city as well. Footnote. That was an acknowledged weakness, as Plautus, Rome's most popular playwright, had growled, "I don't much like these highly connected women, their airs, their huge dowries, their loud demands, their arrogance, their ivory carriages, their dresses, their purple, who reduce their husbands to slavery with their expenses." End of footnote. Already it was acknowledged that the greatest wars have taken place on account of women. Whole families had been ruined on their account. And already, the fault as ever of the sultry, sinuous, overtly subversive East, Egyptian women had caused their share of trouble. They were endowed with insatiable ardor and phenomenal sexual energy. One husband was not enough for them. They attracted and ruined men. Octavian only corralled the evidence. He had found a cunning disguise for a civil war, which 4 years earlier he had declared officially over, and into which he had promised never again to lead his men. How much more palatable, how much more credible, that Antony should be destroyed by an illicit love than by his countrymen. It was by no means difficult to rally legions, or tax the populace, or set fathers against sons, with the claim that Cleopatra was poised to conquer them as she had conquered Antony. As Lucan formulated the battle cry a century later, "Would a woman, not even Roman, rule the world?" The logic was simple. The Egyptian queen had subdued Antony. Rome, Octavian warned, was next. At the end of October, he declared war on Cleopatra. The declaration could not have been unexpected. It may even have come as a relief. Cleopatra must all the same have been surprised by its terms. She had engaged in no hostilities toward Rome. She had comported herself like the ideal vassal, if a vassal with privileges. She had maintained order in her kingdom, supplied Rome when called upon to do so, materialized when summoned, aggressed upon no neighbors. She had done everything in her power to uphold and nothing to diminish the surpassing greatness of Rome. Traditionally, a three-step process preceded a Roman declaration of war. The Senate submitted a demand for restitution, followed after a month by a solemn reminder that satisfaction was still wanting. 3 days later, a messenger traveled to enemy territory formally to open hostilities. Octavian summoned Cleopatra neither for an accounting nor an airing of charges. He made no overtures through diplomatic channels. Instead, deft as ever with the mise-en-scene, he dusted off the ceremonial portion of the process. In a military cloak, he personally launched a spear drenched in pig blood toward the east, from a ritual patch of hostile soil in Rome. There is speculation that he invented this ancient rite for the occasion, that Octavian was making up the history as he went along. He was very good at restoring traditions, including those that had never existed. There were no official charges for the simple reason that none could be leveled. Insofar as Cleopatra stood accused of any hostile intent, she was condemned for her acts, conveniently left unspecified. Octavian gambled that Antony would remain true to Cleopatra, a loyalty that, under the circumstances, allowed Octavian to charge that his compatriot had voluntarily taken up war on the side of the Egyptian woman against his native country. At the end of 32, the Senate deprived Antony of his consulship and relieved him of all authority. Footnote. Stripped of his powers, Antony was now formally without the right to call upon assistance from client states or to distribute Roman territories. By some contorted logic, it could be argued that Cleopatra, therefore, abetted a private citizen hostile to Rome, and that she stood in possession of lands that should not have been hers. To do so was, however, to include Antony in the indictment, in which he nowhere figured. End of footnote. Antony and Cleopatra did their best to spin the underhanded provocation. They were obligatory allies now. Under the circumstances, they cried, how could anyone trust a blackguard like Octavian? What in the world does he mean, then, by threatening us all alike with arms, but in the decree declaring that he is at war with some and not with others? Antony implored his men. His double-dealing colleague schemed.